Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. North America, as we know, for millennia has been populated by ethnic groups from around the world looking for a new place to live. Beginning in the early 17th century and through the present time, Jewish people have seen North America as a favored place to live, and in waves of migration over time have come here to make a new life as part of the American fabric. In the winter of 2008, the public broadcasting system presented a major six-hour television series, The Jewish Americans, Three Centuries of Jewish Voices in America. A companion book to this series, with the same name as the series, written by Beth Wenger, the director of the Jewish Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania, is a collection of first-person stories about lives of American Jews, immigrants, and their children, who maintained their own culture as they became part of the American culture. Our visit with Beth Wenger by phone from her office at the University of Pennsylvania began when she described the distinctions and similarities of the Jewish American experience as compared to the experiences of other immigrant groups.
There are a lot of similarities with other ethnic groups, but certainly there are distinctions. Some of them come from the fact that the Jews negotiate both as a religious and an ethnic group at the same time. Some of the ways they negotiate their status and their culture in the United States is similar to what Catholics might do, for example. You could compare to what Italians do or Hispanics do. You know, so there's a dual process going on there for Jews.
Well, how would you distinguish between a religious group and an ethnic group?
Certainly, in the case of Jews, it's quite intertwined. I'm just saying that Jews negotiate as both. And then certainly it's true about many other groups as well. I mean, it's not unique to Jews. For Jews, of course, these things are quite connected, although there are certainly Jews who identify secularly and politically, and that's their Jewish identity. There are fewer Jews who identify only as a religion and wouldn't also, for example, think of themselves culturally or think of a broader cultural heritage. But one can have a very strong Jewish identity without having a connection to Judaism.
Are you speaking currently in 2008 or from the perspective of when Jewish people first came to America in the 1600s?
Well, it's certainly true currently, and there's no question about that. It's true fairly early on, although I wouldn't say that's true of those Jews who come in the early 1600s, in the sense that, for example, when Peter Stuyvesant initially resists the notion of allowing Jews to settle in New Amsterdam, later in New York, the major thrust of his desire to prohibit Jews from settling is a religious one. He doesn't want to see Jews as a class, as a religion in the colony, because it would upset what his vision for what it should be. Now, he's overruled, of course. So in that time, I would say Jews are really, they're certainly treated and they define themselves as a religion, and they wouldn't use the term ethnic group. It's anachronistic for that period. But certainly they would have thought of themselves as both a community and a culture and a religion.
Well, then, and perhaps as now, Jewish people had a certain stigma attached to them. How would you characterize that?
Well, I mean, again, part of it has to do with an outsider status that comes from their European experience. Jews, certainly in the medieval and early modern periods, and even in some places in the modern period, aren't identified as Jews, meaning as a corporate group in society. Now, they aren't the only ones. There are many, you know, we're not talking about a time that saw citizenship and the notion of individual rights. That's percolating in certain places just at the time when the United States is founded, right? The French Revolution is really the prime example of that, when the notion of individual rights and citizenship in the modern nation state come into being. But that's when that changes. I mean, before that, Jews are treated as a group. They're taxed as Jews. They run their community as Jews, and they pay taxes back to the government. There is a community that's sanctioned by the government that controls every aspect of religious, social, economic life for Jews. You can't opt out of that community in this period. Now, when Jews come to the United States, it's a completely different story, because the government has no interest in regulating any religious life. And so because of that, the Jewish community doesn't have the same control over individual Jews as had been the case in many European societies.
In other words, stay within the terms of the society and the prescriptions as put down by the government.
Exactly. We have these, it's not in the book, I have to say, we have these fascinating synagogue minutes from the earliest synagogues in America, and I'm thinking particularly of Sherith Israel in New York. And you can see the leaders of the synagogue trying to run their synagogue with strict controls, fining Jews for this infraction and that infraction and not coming to meetings, and you can't do this and you can't do that. They're trying to hold on to control, but it doesn't work in the United States because there is pluralism, because the government doesn't get involved in religious life. And it creates a different community, and from the first day, a voluntary community. And it sets the stage for a very, very different kind of Jewish life.
So when you're describing it, what years, what time period are you characterizing?
Well, here I'm talking about really the 1700s, the early, very early periods in Jewish life. And that, by the way, what I described, that falls away very quickly, that attempt to run synagogues that way. And quickly, what happens is, of course, that's what scholars call the monopolistic synagogue, meaning one synagogue in one town, you know, the only one in town that runs everything. That gives way very quickly in the United States, and you get multiple synagogues and people doing, you know, a group of people, they want what they want out of their religious life, and they go open their own down the street, which, by the way, is exactly what goes on with Christian denominations. So that's a pattern of American life that changes Jewish life.
Well, then as things change in Europe in the 17, 18, 1900s, and more Jewish people immigrate to America, the quantity, the numbers of people, and from whence they came changes. How does that adjust and meld the American Jewish experience?
Well, like other communities, the American Jewish community is characterized by successive waves of immigration. And you get a large wave of immigrants in the mid-1800s coming from Central Europe. They're often referred to colloquially as German Jews. But really, they come from many areas in Central Europe. And they bring the community to, let's say, about 250,000 by the time you get to the mid to late 1800s. And then, of course, the large wave of East European Jews who come in the period of mass migration that is about 1880 to the 1920s. And that's about 2.5 million.
And that's urged on by the forced conscription that was going on in Eastern Europe. The conscription into the Russian army, the Polish army.
That's part of it. There are actually a lot of factors. Conscription, many people, I have to say, erroneously think it's the pogroms that erupt, especially in 1881 and then in subsequent years. In Eastern Europe, what's going on is a combination of factors. A population explosion among Jews, restrictive legislation that really makes it tough to earn a living, and there is, you know, sporadic violence as well against Jews. And all this prompts Jews to want to leave. Most are coming seeking better lives. seeking, you know, economic success, and because they really were having trouble making a living. There was just extreme poverty in Eastern Europe. It's a period of, by the way, incredible change, this 40 years or so that bracket the turn of the 20th century. Fully a third of Jews around the world are on the move, moving east to west, with the majority eventually settling in the United States.
Seeking a better life because where their home was just wasn't working.
They had a very tough time making a living. I mean, that really is, and support, feeding and supporting their families because of all these factors, economic, demographic, restrictive legislation. And again, there has been much, popularly people will say it's the pogroms. And the pogroms certainly heighten the sense of anxiety and vulnerability among Jews. But, for example, we know from recent studies that migration occurred at an equal, sometimes even a greater pace from those areas in Eastern Europe that experienced absolutely no anti-Jewish violence. So there was more at work than just pogroms.
Anti-Jewish violence is the definition of a pogrom. Can you elaborate on that?
I don't want to minimize the terror that pogroms caused, because they certainly did cause great terror among Jewish communities. We're talking here about what we know in the 21st century and what happened later in the 20th century. We're talking much more about people getting beaten up. There were people killed, but certainly not in the numbers that we saw certainly later.
During World War II.
During World War II. And, you know, so I mean, it was what I would characterize as sporadic violence against Jews, brought on by a number of factors.
So you're telling us that the significant and huge wave came from 1880 to 1920.
First immigrants come to Castle Garden, and then after around 1892 to Ellis Island. No, that wave of migration ends in the 1920s, it slows to a trickle in the 1920s because of restrictive legislation and quotas that go into effect.
Produced by the United States government.
Exactly.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Beth Wenger, the author of The Jewish Americans, Three Centuries of Jewish Voices in America, which is part of a public broadcasting system television series that's broadcast in January of 2008. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Beth Wenger, tell us about the restrictive legislation that occurred in the United States.
Immediately after immigrants begin arriving in the United States in such large numbers, and here, by the way, not only Jews, but also especially Italians. We're talking about immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe. And even, you know, in the 1890s, you have a group of restrictionists and nativists who fear that somehow these foreigners are destroying the social order, the social fabric of American society, that they're just not going to be real Americans. And so there are various pieces of legislation introduced over the course of many, many years to try to limit the number of immigrants who can arrive. And the strictest legislation finally passes in 1924, and that greatly limits how many immigrants, especially from Southern and Eastern Europe, can come to the United States. And that really slows immigration to a trickle.
And that's somewhat as an ideological successor to the isolationist activities that were going on in the United States right after World War I.
In some ways. But it also has to do with an internal, I would say, fear of, you know, about these immigrants, you know, taking over American society. They were building cities, and, you know, they didn't have that citizen-farmer ethic that people still idealize as part of American society.
When you say these immigrants, do you include all immigrants, or is that directed towards the Jewish immigrants?
Jews are a large part of it, but as I said, so are immigrants from Southern Southern Europe also here, especially Italians who come in large numbers. They're not, they're seen as, frankly, because this is a time of a lot of pseudoscience, they're seen as other in a way that, for example, immigrants from Western Europe are not. Those are good stock immigrants as opposed to those from Eastern and Southern Europe.
In your book, The Jewish Americans, you devote a section to Albert Einstein. It's called The Jewish Point of View. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I should back up and explain that the book itself is designed as first-person voices of American Jews over three centuries. So just so listeners understand, the book has introductory chapters that lay out the contours of American Jewish history, but within each chapter, I've included first-person narratives from all sorts of American Jews, famous, ordinary men, women, writers, politicians, actors, you know, business people, and as I said, ordinary immigrant Jews, you know, working in sweatshops or going out west as pioneers. I say this just to give a context for the Einstein entry, which is one of the entries I included. And part of it was to show different kinds of Jewish identity. You know, Einstein came with the relatively small migration of refugee scholars allowed to enter the United States in the 1930s. You know, quotas were still in effect at that time, so not many people could leave Europe and come to the United States, but many scientists and scholars were permitted to come to the United States, and Einstein was one of them. And he wrote this piece about his own sense of Jewish identity, and he doesn't have a strong religious sense of identity, but he sees in Judaism a moral and ethical outlook that is very important to his sense of himself as a Jew. He, by the way, is also a very strong Zionist. He's very committed to Zionism. In fact, he gives the opening inaugural address at the Hebrew University when it opens. In part, I put him in there. Yes, he's well-known, but also because I tried throughout the book to give a diversity of voices and a diversity of opinions on what it is to be an American Jew. And his is one perspective that, although many Jews couldn't articulate it as eloquently as I think he can and does, but I think it represents a strand of American Jewish identity that people will recognize.
When you mentioned Zionism, how would you describe that?
You know, Zionism in the United States is a small movement for a very, very long time. It doesn't really capture the imagination of American Jews the way it does European Jews. In fact, most American Zionists see the movement as something that will solve the Jewish problem in Europe. In other words, Zionism is a solution to the crisis of European Jewry, giving Jews somewhere to go, especially East European Jews. Zionism begins to take off the unlikely leadership of Louis Brandeis in the 19-teens, who is a very highly acculturated Jew who had very little connection to his Jewish identity or to Judaism for much of his life, and becomes, through a series of interactions with Jews, especially in settling some labor disputes, becomes very connected to Zionism and becomes he gives it legitimacy by his leadership and his very strong, fervent declarations that Zionism is not inconsistent with American patriotism. That he even goes so far as to say, you know, to be a good American, one must be a Zionist as a Jew. And
well, what is Zionism? How would you define it?
Well, that's a good question. It's a loaded question. The truth is, there are many definitions of what Zionism means. There are those American Jews who believe there should be a homeland. There are those who think there should be a state. In its broad definition, Zionism argues for a Jewish homeland, for a place where Jews can be sovereign in some way over their own community. Because, of course, in the European Jewish community, Theodor Herzl, for a brief time, you know, wants to put it in a place in Uganda. You know, it wouldn't have to be Palestine. Now, that was not widely accepted. So in its early years, Zionism had many, there were many, many different visions for Zionism. There were many visions of who should settle, what the culture should look like. It's a very complicated question. But as I said, American Jews are slow to come to the Zionist movement, but it really picks up in the 30s, begins to gain more and more adherence and great support, and eventually comes to be a very important part of American Jewish life.
So one definition of Zionism might be to relocate in a homeland and draw people from Jewish people from around the world who want to develop a community and perhaps what is evolving into Israel as a nation.
Sure, that would be that absolutely would be one definition. I mean, Zionism comes about because of a crisis in European society and the notion that maybe Jews will never fit in, and then also the notion that Jews need a place to go. And that's really what motivates it in Europe. And again, American Jews are a bit removed from that. So for them, that crisis is something they see from afar.
Let's talk about social justice and the Jewish participation in social justice, labor movements, the civil rights movement, the peace movements.
Well, those are very different sorts of movements. I mean, of course, Jews are quite involved in the labor movement, and they're right there. They're working in the factories. So this is part of their lives, and many had been involved in Jewish socialism and leftist movements before they came. Others are here and, you know, feeling the harsh labor conditions and poor, meager wages of the factories and join in the strikes because of, you know, to ameliorate that, their own condition. The Jewish labor movement had its own rhythm. I mean, Jews did join with other workers in the movement, but of course there was a unique character to Jewish labor, and it was quite caught up with Jewish socialism and with the Yiddish press. So there was also a very strong ethnic Jewish strand to the labor movement. And they led many of the strikes, you know, especially in the height of the labor movement from around 1909 to right before World War I.
Which caused a certain amount of animosity towards the people involved in the strikes and Jewish people who were peripheral to the strikes.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, there's an internal class conflict because many of the owners of these shops were Jews. Jews of a different class, many who had come over in a previous migration and who had become involved in the clothing industry and manufacturing when it was in its infancy, when the sewing machine was just becoming, just coming into greater use and becoming more sophisticated, and when ready-made clothing, especially after the Civil War, became much more a part of American life, and Jews drifted into clothing manufacture. And then the East European immigrants largely work in the shops that they own. So this is an internal conflict within the Jewish community.
Do we see a similar internal conflict in the civil rights movement, or in the anti-Vietnam movement, or in the current movement against the existing war now in 2008?
I wouldn't say similar, only because it's such a very different time in American history and in American Jewish history by the time you get to the 60s than it was, you know, in the 19-teens. But certainly, if the question is more broadly, that Jews differ politically and socially, absolutely. I mean, there were those Jews who were passionately involved in the civil rights movement, disproportionately so. And there were certainly those Jews who felt that it wasn't a good idea for Jews to be so prominently represented in that struggle. So, I mean, there's nothing ever about the Jewish community that had been that's been monolithic. There have always been differences politically, socially, economically, culturally, and that continues from day one, you know, in every period of American Jewish history.
Well, Beth Wenger, author of The Jewish Americans, Three Centuries of Jewish Voices in America, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I should say you're catching me just after a very rare vacation on my part. I have to say I never have the chance to read novels, which I'm sorry to say. But over this vacation, I read a book that's been out for a little while, and it's been on my reading list. I read The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is a great book. Also with the Jewish... I read other things, believe it or not, but also with a strong Jewish content about a... I mean, if I explain it, it won't have the power that the book actually has, about, you know, had Jewish history worked out differently and Israel not succeeded as a notion, and the book is about a Alaskan Jewish province that was inhabited by Jews as a sovereign, not state, not nation, but territory. And it's also a detective story and a mystery. It's a great book.
Who's the author?
Michael Chabon.
Well, Beth Wenger, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much.
Beth Wenger is the author of The Jewish Americans, Three Centuries of Jewish Voices in America. The book she recommends is The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.